Hello there. Welcome to the Frenchie Podcast, a show dedicated to the stories and legacies of the French-speaking Cajuns of World War II, as told by the veterans themselves. I'm your host, Jason Theriault.
And I'm his co-host, May Theriault.
For over 20 years, we've been interviewing World War II veterans and capturing their stories. Many of them were Cajuns, people of Acadian descent.
When these young Cajuns went overseas, their ability to speak French proved invaluable to military operations, and it had a profound impact on their sense of Cajun identity. What emerged from this unique wartime experience was a long-lost pride in their heritage. When the military needed bilingual interpreters, they called on Frenchie to bridge the language gap.
Is it recording? It is. Go ahead.
This is May Theriault interviewing General LeBron, right? Is that
LeBron?
Right. And we're here at his house. And he is a World War II veteran, and as well a spy, was a spy. And I am excited to interview him.
And what's the date?
August 3rd, 2019.
Okay.
Wow, man. So that was in August of 2019. So you were 11 years old. Now, not many kids that young have had the opportunity to interview a World War II hero, especially a spy like General Bob LeBlanc. And yes, indeed, he was a spy. He was a Frenchie OSS officer who worked closely with the French underground in France and in Normandy. And I met him over 20 years ago. We became good friends and shared the stage with him a number of times. And General LeBlanc lived to be about 100 years old. And he died a few years ago. And boy, do we miss him. Bob LeBlanc from Abbeville. He was one of a kind. May, that was a special moment. What do you remember about that interview?
Well, I don't remember much because, of course, I was so young. But I do remember him talking about his comrades and how close they had to become because they were far from home and whatnot. So I do remember that part.
Well, if we get a chance, we'll play the full clip of that interview towards the end of this show. So we're glad to be back with another episode of the Frenchie Podcast. And this one is special for a number of reasons. Obviously, I'm here with my co-host and daughter, May Theriault, who just turned 18 and will be off soon to a well-respected institution of higher learning. And we thought it would be neat to have her co-host this episode to showcase her radio voice and mass communication skills, as those aptitudes may come in handy in her future field of choice, or at least get her a part-time job in college to cover her Chick-fil-A expense account.
Well, it could get me a job in college at KLSU or Eagle 98.1 FM. Or that no-name TV station that went out of business, just like you did, Dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true, but you may have to get a second job so you don't starve.
All right, well, what about part-time sports agent? You know, they are paying these college athletics now big bucks, right, Dad?
Right. Okay, well, how about starting off with a business degree, and maybe you can get a weekend gig at that respectful establishment in Tigerland where I met your mom.
Right. All right, Dad. Let's get on with the show. The audience is here for the veteran stories, as told by the veterans themselves, as you have said yourself.
Right. Okay, well, we do have a special treat for the listeners. This episode, aptly titled Les Femmes Frenchies, will feature a few stories from Lady Cajuns who served our great country during World War II. First up is Effie Tanner Logan, a Lafayette native who was in the Army Nursing Corps and served 18 months overseas in a hospital unit in North Africa and Italy. I interviewed Miss Effie in 2002, and she and I became fast friends. And she would attend all of my book signings and book talks that I gave throughout Acadiana in the early days of the To Honor Our Veterans project, long before you were born, May. She was such a lovely soul, really, and she had an amazing story about treating so many wounded soldiers in Tunisia and Naples and on the outskirts of Monte Cassino for that horrific battle that cost thousands of casualties from just about every nationality involved in that Italian campaign. And like so many of her generation, she jumped headfirst into the war effort. When the war broke out, she joined the Army Nurse Corps and volunteered for the LSU Hospital Unit that was stationed at Fort Jackson in South Carolina. Effie's basic medical training lasted a year, and in early 1943, the LSU Medical Unit, designated the 64th General Hospital, was sent to a staging area at Camp Shanks in New Jersey, where they prepared to sail across the Atlantic Ocean. So they boarded a huge troop ship with 106 nurses, 500 enlisted men, and 66 doctors, plus all of their medical equipment and gear, and they set sail for North Africa.
My name is Effie Tanner Logan, and I was born March the 3rd, 1921. My birthday's coming up soon. I'll be 82 years old. The people want to know how come in those days women didn't join the Army. I had recruited us from the Red Cross recruited us. They were the reserve of the Army and Navy for nurses. And they recruited us, and we got our orders right after December the 7th. I got my orders at the end of the 1st of January of 42. And I reported to Fort Benning, Georgia. It was the Army Nurse Corps then. Now it's just Army, U.S. Army.
So it wasn't the Women's Auxiliary Corps?
No, no, that can't. That wasn't women. Even organized.
Okay.
We were the first military women. We had to drill out on a dusty field. Our drill sergeant thought it was hard to teach us how to do a about face and to rear march, but we had to drill. And we first started drilling with our white uniforms and white shoes, but they thought that wasn't appropriate, so we did. They did give us some fatigues to drill. And we had to go through a gas chamber with our gas, learn to go enter it, and then learn to put our gas mask on before we breathe. So it was a rigorous training, and most of us were real young. I mean, we were in our early 20s. Some of them were older, and it was hard on them.
The 64th Hospital Unit from LSU arrived at Bizerte Harbor in Tunisia in the fall of 1943, about a year into the North African campaign, and shortly after the invasion of Sicily, where it set up a 1,000-bed unit hospital to tend to wounded troops from Operation Husky.
We did set up the hospital, and the patients we got were from Sicily. That's when the campaign in Sicily, and we got those casualties. And the thing that I remember so well was one of the artillery officers. He'd gotten wounded, and he would cry and cry because, talk about friendly fire. Our artillery shot down, I think, over 20 American planes with parachutes. And by the time they got to us, see, they'd been in evac hospitals in Sicily. By the time they got to us, they were going to live. You know, they were badly wounded, but they were going to live. We didn't find out how really horrible it was till we were 6 miles, and hospital was 6 miles from the battle. It seems like everything was a military secret. Because my first letter I wrote home, I got it back with something cut out of it. And all I said was, we're stationed near where your brother is. I didn't think that was a military secret. And a lot of us got sick there in Africa. But they would make us send to the patient's mail. And our mail, the mail officer, you know, he'd bring us a bunch of mail for us to read and censor. And one of the patients said, I said, I'm not putting my name on this. It's to his mother and father. I said, I'm not putting my name on this letter. It's not a military secret. But he said, the nurses and the doctors here look like bandits. So I went silent.
That's not a secret.
That's not a military secret. way we had to dress and fatigued, and our chief nurse said, oh, we had to wear caps, and we wore the helmet liner that knitted the cap. Wow. It wasn't very flattering. Nights was the hardest in Africa because we had to take care of about six tents full of soldiers, and one tent was leak, and the soldiers were just so wonderful. That one time a tent was leaking and the soldier had pneumonia, and he said, oh, nurse, I was moving his cot, trying to move him on his canvas cot. He said, oh, I'll just put my blanket over my head. Don't do that. I'm okay. I mean, they were just wonderful. Yeah. They were wonderful. They were so glad to be alive.
Effie and the 64th Hospital Unit spent 6 months in North Africa tending to the wounded and helping those veterans of the Sicily campaign recuperate from their injuries. The hospital unit eventually transferred to Naples, Italy, during the Battle of Monte Cassino in January 1944 and treated many soldiers from the Rapido River crossing that resulted in 2,000 American casualties in one day. But they didn't just treat Americans. They treated everybody.
There's not a nationality you can name that we didn't get. Germans. We laughed because all the Germans would tell us they were from Poland. And we'd say, well, aren't there any German soldiers? But we did get some Hitler youth, and they weren't too nice. They sent some of us to the VAC hospital, and they sent some to Anzio.
And where did you go? You went to the VAC hospital? Where was that?
It was at Volterra, Italy. Volterra, the 15th VAC hospital. We helped them, with the casualties from Anzio. Mm-hmm. And then we moved up. After Anzio, they went into Rome. And then we went, they sent us to Rome to get on a plane, a transport plane, to fly to Livorno, which is Leghorn, mm-hmm. Italy. And we arrived at, Mussolini had built this big complex for parachute training. And so it housed us, our hospital, and the 33rd General Hospital. No, 33rd Station. We General Hospital and Station Hospital. And we were 6 miles from the front lines. Mm. We hadn't crossed the Arno River and to Pisa. And we were there in this building. It was good buildings because Mussolini had built it. They never got to use it even. And there was a big Red Cross painted in the courtyard. And the first night we were there in this building, there was an air raid in the harbor, Leghorn. Mm-hmm. That was the last air raid. every place we went, it was always the last air raid, which was good. And it was the flak was hitting our windows, and I said, "Everybody, get under your cot." And so they were mad at me because the floors were dusty and dirty, and they had gotten showers. But anyway, I don't know whether this is written anywhere, but. The 10th Mountain, every time I hear about them, I think about the 10th Mountain.
10th Mountain Division.
They landed at Leghorn. That was their first, and they went out, they bivouacked them in a minefield. And they called the medics in there, instead of the engineers, and it was terrible. It was terrible.
They got cut up by the mines?
You couldn't even see where their wounds were in the... we had the shock unit, and one boy had come in. He was sitting in a wheelchair. And he said, "Oh, I grew up with this guy. Nurse, don't worry about him." And he was in shock. We were giving him plaster and everything. You couldn't see even where he was wounded, and so he went to surgery, and he didn't survive. And that boy came around looking for him, later. And I had to tell him that he had died in surgery, and I asked the surgeon later, how was he wounded? He said there was about 20 perforations in his intestines from the shrapnel. And they hadn't even seen combat, and one boy had lost his arm, and he said, here I'm going back to the United States, I don't even have a souvenir to bring to my wife. So some of us went to Florence and we bought, they gave us some money, but it wasn't really enough, but we bought jewel boxes in Florence, you know, and all the inlaid, you know, nice little gifts to bring to their wives. Basilica, the day that Pisa was taken, I mean, but, you know, we just never feared anything. I did fly, I flew in an observation plane over the Leaning Tower the day before Pisa was taken. And they said that Germans won't shoot this plane down because they don't want to waste the ammunition. That was a crazy thing. When the war ended, I got orders to go directly to the Pacific, and I hadn't been home in 3 years. And so I got my orders, somebody brought me my orders while I was taking a patient's blood pressure, and the tears were falling on the patient. Well, I wanted to go home, and so the chaplain happened to go by, and he said, oh, what's the matter? I said, I got my orders, and they're sending me directly to the Pacific, and he said, later on, I got a phone call that said, the chaplain wants to see you in his office. So I went to his office, and he said, the patients always said, never tell the chaplains your troubles because they're going to tell you theirs. But anyway, that's what the patients used to say. And so that was really true because I told him, I said, I have to go to the Pacific, and I haven't been home in 3 years. He said, well, I haven't been home in 4 years or something like that. And he said, they're making me stay over here in the Army of Occupation. So I thought about what the patients used to say about the chaplains. If you tell them your troubles, they tell you his. So anyway, he says, I tell you what you do. You go to the base section to the chief nurse there and tell them how many points you have. See, they let the nurses who married come home. And they didn't have as many points as I had, because I went in the Army before they did.
Right.
And so I did go to the chief nurse in the base section, and so she says, you have to go to the Pacific. But she said, we're going to write orders for you to go home first. Well, I was thinking about going home before I'd go to the Pacific, and so, of course, we still had patients, and they were sending them home, you know, when there was space. And the patients just, one day said, oh, nurse, come here, come here. And hear what they said on the radio. They dropped a bomb in on Tokyo.
Now, they didn't just let anyone go home from war. They had a point system. And Miss Effie had just enough points to go home. So, she packed her bags and hitched a ride home on ship, headed back to America. It took about a month, and there was much to reflect back on during that long journey home. She had seen the horrors war had to offer, had made lifelong friends, and had traveled to faraway places, all to serve her country.
Yeah, I took a boat home with the Italian war bride. Italian war brides. You know, the soldiers who married the Italian girls. Yeah.
And so all the girls were going back to the United States without the soldiers?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the soldiers had already gotten back to the States, so their wives came back.
Well, that must have been an interesting ride home.
Yes. We were sad sacks.
So you land back in New Jersey?
We landed at Boston. And we were standing on deck, and tears were flowing from everybody's eyes, and the soldier next to me said, oh, it's because the cold wind is, he says, I'm not crying, he said, when we saw land, you know, the
America with their gleaming cities.
See the Statue of Liberty?
No, this was in Boston Harbor. Yeah, this is in Boston Harbor.
That must have been a very emotional moment.
Oh, it was. It was to see America again.
Lieutenant Effie Tanner was really proud of her service, and when her fiancé from up north offended her when she finally returned from overseas duty, she told him to take a hike.
What happened was, when I got my discharge at Fort Bragg, I called him up and he said, "You're going to come by Louisville to see me?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Well, I want you to go out and buy yourself some clothes and not wear that uniform." And that was the end of my 4.5-year romance, a 5-year romance.
How dare you?
Because how dare you, after what I went through, and I told him, I said, "I'm just as, you know, I told him, I'm just as proud of that uniform as you were of yours."
Effie Tanner Logan passed away in 2012. She was 91 years old. Her nursing career spanned almost 70 years, and she was buried with full military honors. Okay, Mae, who do we have up next?
Up next is a Cajun lady from the Bayou Country who was Rosie the Riveter.
And who was Rosie the Riveter?
Rosie was the name given to the female shipyard workers who riveted and welded together the war machines. See, during the Second World War, there were about 16 million men who served in the military, and so there was critical shortage of labor in virtually every sector of the economy. Factories and war plants needed skilled workers to fill the gap left behind when most men joined the service. That's when thousands of women across the country answered the call to contribute their time and energy to the war effort. They left the comfort of their own homes and moved into major industrial cities to find work. The factories that built the tanks and warships hired and trained these ambitious, hard-working young women as welders and mechanics. Rosie the Riveter became the poster girl for the woman ironworkers. She was depicted as a tough, well-built female factory worker who was not afraid of the dirty, sweaty, and often dangerous work in the plants. It was Rosie and her army of 6 million female workers who produced the B-29s, Higgins boats, Liberty ships, Sherman tanks, and 50 caliber machine gun bullets that were used to win the war. Beulah Duga, a native of the small community of Coto Holmes near St. Martinville, Louisiana, was one of hundreds of Cajun women who became Rosie the Riveter.
That's right. And when the war broke out, Beulah LaViolette was her maiden name. She had worked at a factory in St. Martinville sewing uniforms for soldiers. And one day a spokesman from Delta Shipbuilding Company in New Orleans came to the factory to recruit female welders. As one of 11 children from a really poor farming family out in the country, Beulah eagerly volunteered. And so she took a 6-week training course at a welding school in Lafayette. And when she was ready, she moved to New Orleans with her sister Annette, who was another Rosie, who worked at another shipyard. And Beulah went to work at Delta building the big famous Liberty ships. And here she is.
Okay, Beulah Duga. Well, then, you want me to say Beulah Duga?
That's fine.
Because I wasn't married then when I started.
Okay, what was your maiden name?
Beulah LaViolette Duga. Well, first they started me by tacking. They wanted to see how much I'd learned, you know. And then they gradually put me up a little higher. And we weren't the men and women was a lot the same. I mean, they didn't treat us any different, you know. And then they made me weld straight lines. And then after that, I don't know what it's called, but they put like two lines to adjust it, to make it stronger.
Uh-huh.
I must have been, I'm sure, 6 months before I went overhead.
Okay.
To well overhead, and we'd go to the bottom decks and mm-hmm. do that too.
How much were they paying you?
When I started, I think it was like 75 cents.
An hour?
An hour.
Okay.
But when I before I stopped, it was 225. I was that was a top.
You were qualified welder.
Qualified welder.
Yeah, oh, man.
And you were helping for the war, you know. When we were poor, and it was helping our parents too, you know, both ways.
I'm sending money back home.
Oh yeah, mostly all of it. And what I kept is a bond, war bond. And I used it for a little bit for my first baby.
Oh.
But I didn't think of being tarred. I thought about being scared. That's what it was.
Yeah,
there was
what,
so many Navy men, Navy people and all that. I was really afraid. I was worried about that. See, we never left home. So it was my first time out in the city.
What a sweet old Cajun lady. I had interviewed Ms. Duga probably around 2002 or 2003. And some years later, she became a feature. Her story became a feature of the National World War II Museum's traveling exhibit called The Pelican State Goes to War, Louisiana in World War II. And that exhibit went around the state to various libraries, archives, and museums. And that was, you know, several years ago. And I believe now it's a permanent exhibit at the museum in New Orleans, the World War II Museum. And on Saturday, October the 20th, 2018, that day served as Beulah Duga Day at the National World War II Museum as they celebrated this Rosie from the wartime shipbuilding in New Orleans. And Miss Beulah and nearly two dozen of her family members and extended family came to that event to honor her that day. And that must have been quite an amazing gathering for the Duga family. Miss Beulah Duga passed away the following spring. All right, now I'd like to introduce everyone to our special guest, Monica Ordonez, who is an award-winning choreographer based in New Orleans, and she is co-founder of the Melange Dance Theater. And Monica reached out to me over a year ago because she had heard about the Frenchie story, and so we talked and I shared some contacts with her, including the love story of a Cajun GI from Houma, Dennis Neal, who met and married his wife, Jeanette, while he was serving as an interpreter in Paris, France. And Monica's studio put together this amazing dance performance based on this Cajun GI love story and several others. And it was held over many nights in November in New Orleans to great fanfare. And sounds like the Love Letters of World War II show might be coming to a city near you real soon. And so I wanted to bring her on the Frenchie podcast to tell us all about this performance. Welcome, Monica.
Hey, Jason. Thanks so much for having me on the Frenchie podcast. I'm excited to be here, particularly for this episode. And thank you for introducing our show, Love Letters of World War II. Love Letters of World War II is a show that's very special to me. It was first presented in 2019 at the Marinier Opera House in New Orleans. The project originated from musician Sarah Quintana, who is based in New Orleans in France. Her booking agent in Marseille, Julie, shared her grandparents' love letters from World War II with Sarah, and then Sarah wrote original music based on their story in collaboration with accordionist Christoph Lampedeckia. So Yvette and Roger were separated in World War II when Roger was deported to a German prison camp. Yvette actually professed her love for Roger right before he left, and their love flourished through letters and literally kept Roger alive in the turbulence of war. Along with the story of Yvette and Roger, we share other wartime stories, including the lesser-known French female resistance members. We really had a positive response to the original show, and I always wanted to bring it back. This time, I knew I wanted to incorporate Louisiana history, especially since we have such a strong connection to France. I Googled World War II, Louisiana, France, and your Frenchie podcast came up. I ordered the book and began listening to the podcast and just completely immersed myself in the stories and was fascinated by this strong link that I was unaware of the first time I conceptualized the show. A big goal of Melange is to share underrepresented and lesser-known stories, so I knew I really wanted to honor the Frenchie and their massive contribution to the Allied victory while shedding light on the importance of maintaining connection to heritage and culture and the strength in diversity. I was immediately drawn to the story of Frenchie Dennis Neal, who served as an interpreter in World War II and met his future wife, Jeanette Cardinal, at the liberation of Paris. How romantic is that? There's so much trauma and destruction in war. It's wonderful to shine light on something beautiful that can come from it. It really fit into the existing framework of love letters, connecting the French Resistance with their story. Since Dennis met Jeanette while joining the French Resistance, and her father was a leader in the French Resistance. Since he spoke French, he drove the colonels around, and if it were not for his knowledge of French, he perhaps may have never met Jeanette. It's an unexpected and beautiful uplift in the show. We're incredibly honored and excited to share that we have been invited to Washington this fall to present love letters at the Library of Congress as part of the Veterans History Project. I plan to continue building the Frenchie story into love letters and will highlight additional stories in our next rendition. We're also looking into bringing love letters to venues in Lafayette and Baton Rouge and hopefully the World War II Museum in New Orleans. Stay tuned for that. I want to give a special shout out to the New Foundation. They are the New Orleans Foundation for Francophone Cultures, and they connected us with the Library of Congress. And thank you, Jason, for your incredible dedication to bringing this history to life. Your work has been a wonderful resource and inspiration for me. I really look forward to what's next. You can learn more about Love Letters of World War II and Melange at www.melangedanceofnola.com, and we're also on Instagram at Instagram/melangedancetheater. Thanks so much for having me, Jason.
And thank you, Monica, and your team for sharing the Frenchie story to your audiences in Louisiana and eventually around the country. I know that the Neal family in Houma and their distant cousins in France will be proud. All right, as promised, here is 11-year-old May Terrio's short interview with World War II legend General Bob LeBlanc at his home in 2019.
So why don't you ask him a couple questions?
How were you recruited into the U.S. Army, right?
How was it recruited into what?
The Army, or as a spy. How were you recruited as a spy?
Oh, how I was recruited by OSS. Well, you speak, read, and write French. That's number one. And the minute you do that, you get a call. And they recruit you to come over and talk to them. And the first thing you know, they say, we're going to recruit you, and you're going to go to next to Washington, D.C. And you're going to be in this place. And if they like you, they're going to keep you. They like me. I ended up in China. I ended up in France. And I ended up in England. But England and France, I worked together. Then after I come out of that, I went to China and served there.
Another question is, how did you get to France? Like, what kind of transportation?
To France?
Yes.
Cross the pond and got into France.
A big P road.
What exactly did you do as a spy?
Huh?
What exactly did you do as your spy? Like, what was your job?
As a spy, it was my job to take the everything that was done by the Third Army. I had to coordinate it with the underground. The Third Army, you know who that is, huh?
Not really.
General Patton's Army.
You know Patton's Army?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it was my job, whatever he was attacking something, to make sure that the underground was supporting him. Okay?
Okay.
When he says the underground, he means the French underground, the French resistance. Because
but the French underground.
Right.
Yeah.
But the French underground. And then when I got through there, they sent me to China.
Ask him what was the OSS.
What was the OSS?
Uh-huh.
What was the OSS?
OSS, Office of Strategic Services. That was what it was called. But our job was to make sure that everything that the army was doing, we got some underground people to do it for.
I think that's all my questions.
Okay, maybe we'll tell them thank you and press stop.
Thank you.
Well, that's pretty cool to hear. I've got a lot of interview recordings from over the many years. I think this one takes the cake. Thank you, May, and General LeBlanc, for this treasured gift. That will do it, folks. I want to thank my co-host, May Terrio, and our special guest, Monica Ordonez, for joining the show. And I thank you, the audience, for tuning in, spreading the word, and sharing your comments. We'll keep making these episodes as long as you folks keep listening. Visit the Frenchie website at www.jasonterrio.com to learn more. Until next time, the Frenchie podcast music is provided by Chris Segura and Josh Caffrey.